Welcome to Blogging Heads TV. I'm Michael Brooks.
And I'm Stephen Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I, as you can actually see behind me, I'm Michael Brooks. I'm a contributor and oftentimes host at the Majority Report, hosted by Sam Cedar, which is a daily political talk show. I also do a podcast for Aslan Media once a week, focusing on Middle East issues, and my writing appears in various places, Washington Post, Al Jazeera, and you can see me sometimes on TV doing, well, similar to what I'm doing now, which is sharing an analysis and opinion that is hopefully helpful. And it's great to be talking with Steve, who I've it's been great to get to know over the past couple of months.
Well, this is a number. How many collaborations have we done now?
A bunch. Yeah, this will be our, because I've talked to you on Intersection twice.
Right.
Then we have, this is our first Blogging Heads, and then we have a piece, actually.
Right,
that's
which
in
I
the
just
works.
Finished. Under yeah. the Wire.
Yeah, so this is, yeah, well.
I actually just sent it to you, so let me know before I get on a plane tomorrow.
Oh, awesome. Okay, great. Well,
great.
That gives you something to look forward to after our talk. So look forward to that as well, the Stephen Cook, Michael Brooks piece coming out. In the not too distant future. So today we want to.
Inshallah, as they say.
Sorry?
Inshallah.
Inshallah, right. Well, that's, well, we'll be definitely talking about a lot of inshallah related news today. So we're talking Turkey today. And, you know, we've actually said this before, that that Turkey's a place that really is. It's gotten more attention in the past couple of years, in the past several years, but it's a pivotal place that never quite seems to be at the head, sort of front and center. But Prime Minister Erdogan and recent events in Turkey have definitely been shifting that. And there were municipal elections there a couple of weeks ago, coming on the heels of corruption investigations, of political purges, of a crackdown on protesters. There's a lot going on. So I guess basically, I mean, what was the verdict of those elections, and how are things looking now, to start off with a, you know, pretty basic aerial
right,
view?
Right. Well, first, as far as the kind of attention that Turkey has gotten recently, it really is unprecedented. I mean, we haven't seen this kind of thing since the days of the Cold War. And even then, Turkey was sort of the most important but most unappreciated ally in the North Atlantic Alliance. People sort of took advantage of the fact that the Turks were this, as people say, that century along, the southeastern flank of Europe. And now it's been getting attention for a host of other reasons. A decade ago, it was getting a lot of attention because this Justice and Development Party, which is an Islamist political party, came to power and undertook a whole range of democratic reforms. And more recently, getting a lot of attention because they're in the process of reversing all of those reforms. I think Turkey is a case study right. in the reversal of those reforms. And it's the reversal of reforms, or slowing down of reforms first and then reversal of reforms, really began a couple of years ago and have accelerated over the course of the last 6, 8, 9 months, beginning with the Gezi Park protests, which began last May 2013, and never really ended. And those were protests over the redevelopment of a park in central Istanbul, but also about the kind of unbounded power of Prime Minister Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party, crony capitalism, police brutality, the inability of the opposition to find a voice. I mean, there was a lot of anger at the Justice and Development Party in Erdogan, but there was also a lot of anger at the opposition parties. People from across the kind of political spectrum, age groups, all came out to protest last spring and summer. And as I said, it really never ended. And then you had, starting in mid-December of 2013, December 17th, stunning corruption allegations against people close to the prime minister, his son, one of his sons, and others. And this has continued all throughout the winter and into the early spring. And of course, as you mentioned, Michael, we had the municipal elections of March 30th, in which, to the surprise of people who only kind of come to Turkey recently, but for those who spend a lot of time looking at it, the Prime Minister's party
not surprised.
Did very, very well.
Right.
44% of the vote retained the mayoralties in Istanbul and Ankara, although the Ankara result is subject to dispute. There are credible reports of fraud related to that. And also, if you look at the kind of electoral geography of the results, in places where the Justice and Development Party was running against others, which, you know, places that weren't entirely safe seats, they didn't do as well as they did in the last municipal elections or the national elections, even though they did very well. Overall, nationally, they lost about 2 million votes, but increased their vote total over the 2009 municipal elections. Their percentage of vote total, I should say. So it's not a great situation to be in opposition to Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party right now. His victory speech, because he wasn't, of course, running for anything, but his victory speech was essentially a warning to his opponents that a crackdown was coming and that they better watch out.
Yeah, this was, I mean, we were actually joking right before we started recording that, you know, Erdogan, with each positive election result for him, he seems to get more angry. You know, his motto is, well, I've won again, so, you know, F you, essentially. I mean, his kind of anger and sense of a persecution complex is really highly developed. And I guess that, you know, I know some people like to avoid a personality conversation in politics at times, and, you know, obviously there's always structural and institutional and economic factors that are very significant. But, you know, Turkey really is a case where you just cannot disaggregate the personality tendencies of this guy from the whole situation. And I think, in two ways. So one is, as you were saying, if you were a new to Turkish politics, you'd think, okay, on the kind of broad left, maybe that's not the best word to describe it, but Gezi represents, as you were saying, it's middle class, it's concern about open political culture, it's concerned about the environment, democratic accountability. Crackdown, I mean, you know, the crackdown was pretty brutal on Gezi. People right. got injured, you know, people died. He had no public remorse about it. I mean, a couple weeks ago, a teenager who had a canister hit him in the face. I don't even think he was part of the protest.
He wasn't. He was out running an errand to get bread. He was actually younger than a teenager. I think he was 12 or something like that. Was
a child, right?
Yeah,
yeah. And he was in a coma. I mean, go ahead. Yeah.
No. And what happened was large protests resulted as a result of his death. The Justice and Development Party, their spokespeople, their entire social media operation was less than sensitive to the death of this youngster. Former minister tweeted out, he subsequently deleted the tweet, but that those who were coming out to express their grief and anger over this death were necrophiliacs. And I think, you know, Erdogan, you're saying it's people are reluctant to engage in personality studies, and I'm certainly one of those people as well. I never, you know, always want to kind of situate it in institutions and politics and structures, but it's really hard in Turkey at times. First, as you said, you know, when they were handing out the magnanimity gene, Erdogan didn't get it. Each victory, he becomes less interested in consensual politics, and it takes the results as a mandate to do as he pleases. And it's also hard not to engage in a certain kind of discussion, speculation, or analysis about his personality, because he has become, you know, what has happened over the course of the last 10 years or so is the emergence of essentially a one-party state, and Erdogan is the sun around which all politics in Turkey revolves. Many decisions that are seemingly mundane decisions, like ones that are left to municipalities, like the redevelopment of the Gezi Park, are things that land on the prime minister's desk. Part of this is his personality. He is, in every way, a kind of a man in full. He is a great politician. He's been able to kind of capture the imagination of average Turks. And that's why they keep voting for him. And the other thing is that he is kind of the center of this patronage this patronage system that has also helped keep the Justice and Development Party in power. And that's in part what this these corruption allegations and these revelations about huge sums of money going to and from the government to companies that are affiliated friendly to the Justice and Development Party and the Prime Minister himself. So it's very, very hard to get away from that. And the last thing, the last piece of this, why you have to account for his personality, is that Prime Minister Erdogan comes from a particular tradition in Turkish politics, the Islamist wing of politics, who have been subject to repression and who have been discriminated against. And as a result, it has become, it seems, ingrained to believe that the next coup, the next round of repression, the next kind of institutional discrimination is just around the corner, and he needs to quash those things in order for him to fully realize his vision of the new Turkey and the vision that is shared by his rather large constituency.
Right, maybe some type of silent majority, unfortunately.
More than silent. I mean, yeah, in the run-up to these elections, you know, he's bringing 300,000 people out into the streets to, you know, to hear what he had to say.
Right. No, absolutely. That's right. Absolutely. So, but there's a couple of things there. And I think we actually should also get back, you know, we will get back briefly to the patronage network and the corruption, because I think it, there's an important point here about how that's happening and why that's happening, which is a little distinct. But I think before we get to that, you know, one of the things that you're alluding to, which is I think also makes this fascinating, you know, and if you're new to this, might be unexpected, is that part of the shock, or for some people, or the disappointment at the course, the way things are going, is not that Erdogan was ever some, you know, great, robust liberal with a, you know, a kind of profound commitment to broad, inclusive democracy. But that said, when this party first came to office in 2002, they really did have some type of shot, it seemed, at merging a certain type of Islamic cultural values with democratic processes, and then also moving Turkey. I mean, they made more
That's
moves
exactly
in the
right.
beginning of government to get closer to the European Union than many previous Turkish administrations who, you know, represented, quote unquote, secular politics. So part of this is that this is a grand, when you're talking about, you know, a regression, you're talking about a regression from a government's own accomplishments within the time span of its own
That's a
government.
Really good point. That's exactly right. I mean, you know, I think the first constitutional package to align Turkey with what's called the Copenhagen criteria. Copenhagen criteria is something that the EU has established for prospective members to meet before they can begin official membership negotiations. So I think the first, the first constitutional package to align Turkish politics took place just before the Justice and Development Party was elected in November 2002. But subsequently, another 7 or 8 packages were pushed through by the Justice and Development Party. I mean, extraordinary types of things that one would never have expected, particularly of an Islamist party in Turkey, but things that made it harder to close political parties, harder to ban politicians, strengthened freedoms of the press, freedoms of conscience, allowed Kurds, for example, to speak their own language, abolished the death penalty, on and on and on and on, to the point where in October 2004, the European Commission recommended that Turkey begin formal membership negotiations for the EU, which began in March 2005. And this was all the handiwork of the Justice and Development Party. And now what we've seen as as it's gotten into trouble has been ignoring these changes or passing laws that actually rescind a lot of the democratic changes and that they themselves forged in the early part of their tenure in 2003 and 2004. It's I think it's going to make a great book or article about the reversibility of political forms. Of course, the Justice and Development Party says that, you know, this is an emergency and they have to take these measures to gain control over what they call a dirty conspiracy by a parallel state and external actors that have, seeking to bring Turkey and its accomplishments down. that plays well, actually, with large numbers of people within their constituency, and that has allowed them essentially to get away with this. And that's why I think we can expect, until Erdogan really does reestablish political control and mastery of the political situation, for you to continue to see him and the party resorting to authoritarian measures. Of course, they'll situate it in law. They'll situate it, they'll pass laws through the parliament, and President Gül has, up until this point, although people are waiting for him to break with the party and break with Erdogan and take a firm stand, he has signed every single one of these restrictive laws.
Right. Yeah. Well, so that's another fascinating thread to follow up on. But
It, we
I
could go
think
on forever.
right. No, I mean, this it's a very, very ripe situation. But I think, the final thread on Erdogan, though, and I want to, run this by you and, see how this kind of what your sense of this is. Because so the other argument that comes up a lot, which is also kind of important to note, and we'll get into some of the details of some of this. So first is, which we were just discussing, that part of the disappointment, besides the intrinsic disappointment of any government moving in an authoritarian, human rights violating direction, is that this government actually had real progress in the beginning of its tenure. The second point, and you've made this point a lot, Steve, is that, some of these things like, I mean, not the specifics of shutting down Twitter, obviously, because Twitter is new, but things like shutting down websites, going after journalists, this, sadly, this is not like a breakthrough in Turkish politics. This is traditional Turkish politics in some ways, unfortunately. So Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party is not doing anything new in some respects. But the thing that does seem new, actually, to me at least, is the level of kind of, and again, it goes back to the personality aspect, the personality-driven nature of what Erdogan is trying to do and make his role in the Turkish state does seem like a new thing. So it seems like you're going from, wow, you're undermining your own progress. It's almost like if Teddy Roosevelt stayed in office and started bulldozing his own, wildlife or,
Right.
eco preserves that he saved. And then secondly, you're doing things that, okay, this is just a tendency in Turkish politics, which you're conforming to. But it does seem like that an aspect of his kind of personalization does seem new, or something that's more analogous to a Peronist thing, or I don't know. I mean, does
Well,
that kind of make sense?
no, it does
Yeah.
in a way. Look, there have been great figures and towering figures in Turkish politics
Sure.
before. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who they renamed
Well, he
Atatürk.
stands,
He stands above all.
He stands above all,
Turgut
sure.
Özal, who was the prime minister in the 1980s and then became the president in the early 1990s before his untimely death, remains a towering figure. The Justice and Development Party has tried to use this figure, Adnan Menderes, as someone who was put to death after the 1960 coup, as someone who is a great hero and who, was obviously unjustly accused by the Kemalist elite. Erdogan, I think, sees himself as the most important Turkish politician since Atatürk. And would like to be remembered as perhaps greater than Atatürk. Look, it's no secret that while the Justice and Development Party and its leader pay lip service to Atatürk as the founder of the Republic, they've done so much to undermine the principles of Kemalism. Now, Kemalism is hardly democratic. And you're quite right in suggesting that the tactics that they've been using as they've gotten in trouble are tactics that Turkish governments have used in the past. Atatürk was an authoritarian. There's nothing in any of the principles, what they call the six arrows of Kemalism that is specifically talks about democracy. And we have seen these authoritarian practices in Turkey throughout. Now, it's also true that Turkey's had more has had a longer period of democratic practices, although it couldn't fairly be called a democracy. Having a multi-party political system beginning in the 1950s is not necessarily does not indicate democratic politics. With Erdogan in particular, I think
Right.
this personalization and this the kind of accumulation of power at the top is, as you said, kind of familiar outside the Turkish political system, and we've seen it in various places. I had a really interesting conversation a few a few trips to Istanbul ago, where I met with representatives of the Nationalist Action Party. Now, this is kind of a neo-fascist party, and right. You know, they want to, they don't recognize the you know, Kurdish ethnic group. So these guys aren't exactly heroes. But he started referring to Erdogan as the pharaoh. And I said to him, "Don't you mean Sultan?" And he said, "No, actually, the Sultan had some checks on his power, whereas the pharaoh had wow. no checks on his power," which was wow. really, really
That's
you know,
stunning.
Telling. Yeah. Erdogan is, you know, really up until December seemed to be in command and invulnerable to political challenges. What's changed since December is that suddenly he seems, and he seems surprised by it, that the depth of anger, and that there are people who pose, at least through the revelations, you know, through tapes and videotapes of the justice and development wrongdoing and businessmen wrongdoing and even members of the Erdogan family wrongdoing, that he is actually vulnerable.
Yeah, so I want to get actually, we'll get to the specific makeup of Erdogan's many, many enemies or people working against him. But I think it's actually, you know, an interesting point, though, to look at. I want to get your take on, first of all, you know, maybe you could give us some more, some of the detail on some of these corruption allegations and how they've been servicing the public, because they're, you know, they're very darkly entertaining in a certain way. But it also seems like, you know, I'm the names are escaping me, but some analysts have made this point. This is not an original point to me, but that, you know, this isn't like the corruption that you're seeing around the Justice Development Party and Erdogan is not necessarily, I mean, sure, people are enriching themselves and there's contracts flowing, but this looks again like another representation of the kind of will to centralize politics. So it's creating a patronage and influence network more so than just securing yourself. You know, Erdogan's less interested in the Swiss bank account and more interested in the kind of all-consuming sort of control of the levers of governance and the levers right. of money and power. So, I mean, is that a better way to kind of look at the corrupt, like how corruption is working in the Justice Development Party?
Well,
that
it may
be part of this project, yeah.
Right. It may very well be that Erdogan is less interested in the, you know, in the Swiss banks, although there's reportedly he has a significant sum in those places. But it's also clear that people around him
yeah.
and people, prominent figures within the Justice and Development Party, are very much interested in those Swiss bank accounts. But to your point about Erdogan, I think it's a very good one. I mean, he seems to be interested mostly in power, in centralizing power, in the idea that nobody, he is an irreplaceable force in politics. And in this kind of narcissistic way, he believes that this is not really corruption. This is what needs to be done in order to effectively transform Turkey. And it's also, it's, you know, the building of these patronage networks. So there's all these, you know, big businesses, these construction firms, these redevelopment, you know, real estate redevelopment firms doing all of this stuff. They don't want to be owning media properties. But the price for them is to purchase a media property that is friendly to and change the editorial line of a newspaper, of a television station, to make it friendly to the government, to ensure that they continue to get government, huge government contracts for, you know, building everything from, you know, rebuilding highways, building new highways, redeveloping parts of Istanbul. I mean, if you look at the Istanbul skyline, there's all these new towers. Many of them are empty towers. I mean, these are just kind of patronage real estate plays. It is all about, for Erdogan, not so much his bank account as it is aggrandizing him as a great leader, continuing his project in the transformation of Turkey, and him knowing essentially what's best for the country, where all these other people really have no idea, quite honestly, what's good for Turkey.
Yeah. So, well, let's, so, okay. So,
I mean, it takes a lot. Yeah. It takes a lot to really believe that about yourself.
No, I mean, it's just an astounding, I mean, Erdogan really is the type of guy where you read about him and you start to kind of, you know, I mean, you know, you're like, oh, well, I guess, you know, comparatively speaking, like guys like George W. Bush and Bill Clinton seem, you know, like relatively modest. And that is, you know, a truly astonishing.
I have had the opportunity to be in Erdogan's presence in relatively close proximity a number of times. And he really is in command of the room.
Right.
People respond to him, even in non-Turkish speaking audiences. He can be very charismatic. He can be aggressive and confrontational, but he's always, you know, the center. I've described it as, you know, he truly is a man in full, and knows precisely what it is that he wants and what he's doing. That doesn't necessarily mean that I think he's a great strategic thinker. But I think he has a broad idea of what he wants. And as you mentioned, Bill Clinton, I've recently written, this isn't coming out. This is for, you know, a new book project that I'm working on that is deals with Turkey in part, that, you know, outside of Bill Clinton, I have never seen a better politician than Tayyip Erdogan. He's extraordinarily good. And he doesn't keep getting reelected because of the, you know, force and coercion and intimidation that he's using against the people who aren't predisposed to like him to begin with, but because he's an inspirational character for those large numbers of Turks who have benefited under the last 10 years, 11 years of Justice and Development Party politics. Let's not forget the fact that there is Erdogan care. People, average Turks now have, you know, healthcare options that they didn't before. They have transportation options that they never had before. Many of them have running water that they didn't have before, and they have some money in their pocket. So, you know, with all of our discussion and all of the focus in the West about, you know, Erdogan the man and Turkey, this important country that's a, you know, quote unquote bridge between East and West, and about, you know, AKP, the Justice Development Party, coming from an Islamist background, the party has done some really important things for large numbers of Turks, and that's why people keep voting for them. In addition to his obvious charisma.
Yeah, I mean, what's Turkish for "it's the economy, stupid"? I mean, that right. makes total sense. So, I mean,
I keep referring to Erdogan care, although I don't know how the website works. It probably works. Yeah.
I would imagine, well, you know, I would say that even if the website didn't work, you wouldn't say that it didn't work, maybe. Or, you know, or at least no one in his cabinet, you know. Who are these people who say the website doesn't work?
It's the interest rate lobby who says that.
Yeah, it's the interest rate lobby. That's one of his favorite targets, or exactly. Twitter. So you know, we'll get back to what might be coming next, but let's actually get into the specifics of all of these people in Turkish society, and I don't mean to sound flippant, but if we're, you know, adopting the Erdogan mindset, all of these people who just, you know, don't get it. What, like, you know, so it seems like we have an official opposition, which, you know, we can speak briefly about. Clearly, they're
very briefly
a lot of problems. Yeah, I mean, that's just the kind of painful truth of it, that they're just not getting electoral traction. Then we have the kind of Gezi coalition, which I think does represent a new kind of trend, new demographics in Turkey. And then there's something called the Gulen movement, which in my mind is probably what would be frightening him most and maybe even enraging him most. So let just kind of run through those three kind of broad sectors.
So we have, you know, the traditional opposition parties, and the main opposition party is the Republican People's Party, which was Ataturk's party. It's nominally a social democratic party, although a number of years ago the European Social Democrats wanted to kick the Republican People's Party out of it for not really being much of a social democratic party. They consistently poll about 25% of the population along the kind of western rim and southern coast of Turkey. Their, you know, strongholds are cities like Izmir, And they really do represent a kind of an elite, a Kemalist elite. Although more recently, the party is made up of people who just don't like Erdogan. The problem that the Republican People's Party has had is that whereas they can tell you over and over again for hours on end, it seems, everything that's wrong with Tayyip Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party, they can't exactly tell you what they are for. There is no kind of positive vision for the future that, you know, gives them any hope to expand their electoral returns beyond this kind of pretty consistent base of 25%.
So there's no one there saying, like, we're a bit more secular, a lot more secular, maybe. And besides that, we're going for 2003 to 2006 in terms of governance, except more secular. Nobody's like coming out with that sort of simple argument.
Well, you know, I think that they've tried to make that case. The problem is that, you know, it's hard for the for this party that really has represented an elite for people who don't belong to the kind of secular, not liberal, but more cosmopolitan lifestyle, for those people to reach out to your average Turk, to people who don't have don't come from those kinds of backgrounds. And they and so under those circumstances, they say, well, we would do the reforms, the democratic reforms, better. Well, why would anybody believe that? They also have their own problem with corruption. And I think, you know, that in part the Gezi Park protests were clearly directed at the Justice and Development Party and clearly directed at Prime Minister Erdogan. But I think that people are also expressing their frustration and disappointment with the fact that the main opposition parties have been absolutely ineffective, and consistently and consistently so. And I think this is one of the problems with the Turkish political system now, that there is no check, there is no opposition check or balance on the Justice and Development Party. People would rather sit home and not vote than vote for the Republican People's Party. And this is certainly accruing to the benefit of the Justice and Development Party. Then there's this other party, the Nationalist Movement Party, which I mentioned before, which is this kind of neo-fascist party. It's a nationalist in they say in not a bad way, but in the worst kind of ways. It's a pretty hardcore nationalist party. It has been a partner in coalition governments during the 1990s and had a very and has a pretty hardline position on Kurdish issues and Kurdish cultural autonomy and Kurdish nationalism. Beyond that, we get into a series of much smaller religious parties and parties smaller parties on the left. So there's really not, and of course the big Kurdish party, which goes by the acronym BDP, the Democratic Society Party, and they do very well in Kurdish areas, but they have not been able to translate that beyond you know, traditional core constituencies in the southeastern part of the country. So that's the parties. Erdogan is then you have this kind of broader, beyond the Republican People's Party, this Kemalist elite, you know, traditional academics, pockets within the media, the military certainly, who are committed and have internalized the ideas of Kemalism, which as is not necessarily democratic, and that had worked for years to suppress and repress any kind of expression of Turks' Muslim identities. You know, that's why you have things like the headscarf ban. That's why you know, religious Muslims were purged from the military or purged from the bureaucracy over the course of many years. So that's another enemy of the Justice and Development Party. And over the course of their tenure, the Justice and Development Party has done a lot to bring the military to heel, first through changing the institutions and laws, and then through what are now believed to be, or have been believed by many people over a longer period of time, trumped up charges against senior military commanders in order to bring the military to heel, to essentially lop off the senior command, put them in jail, and cultivate a new set of officers who would be, if not necessarily loyal to the institutions of the state, certainly understand that I mean not loyal to, so subordinated to the institutions of the state, subordinated to the current political leadership, which has its own problems. And then, of course, there is this Gulen movement, of which there has been much written about in the popular reporting on Turkey, but not a lot of understanding. And that's not because journalists aren't smart and aren't talented, but because the Gulen movement, in many ways, operates in the shadows. Its leader is this cleric who is in Pennsylvania, but essentially reclusive. There have been rumors since, you know, I was living in Turkey in the, you know, late 1990s and 2000s about Gulenist infiltration of the bureaucracy. They have, you know, business associations, television channels, the press. One of the best known English language newspapers in Turkey is a Gulenist newspaper that's called Today Zaman, and has a reputation for excellent reporting, actually.
Very good newspaper, yeah.
But yeah, and so they have been the ones who have been fingered by Erdogan as the parallel state that has engaged in this quote-unquote dirty conspiracy to bring Turkey to its knees. And there, you know, there have been these, you know, kind of tit-for-tat revelations about wrongdoing on the part of the AKP, and then Erdogan will turn around and he'll purge, you know, the police forces and the prosecutors, the judges, and so on and so forth to try to root out the Gulenists. And you've had this kind of back and forth between the two. And these municipal elections that were held on March 30th were supposed to be this kind of showdown between Gulenist power versus the AKP. And of course, the Gulenists don't have their own political party. They see themselves as just an NGO. I think that it was clear that they were signaling to their constituency and Fethullah Gulen, this cleric's followers, that they should vote for people other than the Justice and Development Party. They didn't direct anybody to vote. They told people to vote their conscience and what's best for Turkey. And they seem to have come up short. Yeah. And now our Gulenists are very concerned about what they all expect to be a crackdown on them, their movement, their NGOs. They've already shut down their schools. And I think we're going to see significant political tension along these lines for quite some time. I think Erdogan takes the municipal elections and the results and the 44% vote total as a mandate to resolve this problem on his terms.
Right, as we said earlier, not to soothe the tensions of the country. I mean,
right.
So is that the next? I mean, you know, that and we should say really clearly. I mean, Erdogan explicitly said that this isn't just some. You know, this isn't kind
right.
Of
this isn't intuitive. Reading between the lines.
Yeah, this is what he said.
I'm coming to get you.
Yeah, right. Like, thank you for the victory.
You are going down.
Right. That would be like if Obama said, "Oh, you know, thank you. I just took the call from Mitt Romney, and you know, the police will be at his campaign
That's right.
quarters shortly." So, I mean, you know. I mean, is that basically what the country is bracing for, where, you know, this kind of next wave of crackdowns across all of these perceived opponents?
It is an expectation. You talk to people who are affiliated with the Gulen movement, or people who are not affiliated with the Gulen movement but are necessarily opposed to Erdogan, everybody expects more purges. Arrests. Now, they haven't crossed the line of just arresting people for, you know, thought, mm-hmm. you know, just thinking and writing different things. They've often, you know, what they've done is they've situated it in, you know, some legal issue, whether it's terrorism or corruption or something else. There are real concerns that people will start being arrested just for what they think and just for being opponents. We haven't seen any evidence of that. And of course, this is a fraught political environment where tensions are high. People are coming to the United States to, you know, plead their case in this kind of erroneous assumption that Washington can decisively influence the trajectory of domestic politics in Turkey.
Right.
And so that is the expectation. It may be different from what we're finding on the ground. In fact, I'm heading to Turkey tomorrow. And so, you know, maybe we can do another one of these, or, you know, we'll talk about some other form.
We'll do this,
but I'll get a sense of the significant fear. You know, years ago, there was this scare that people were, you know, that their phone calls were being listened to, their cell phones were tapped, and so on and so forth. And people, you know, that you would meet, they would take the batteries out of their cell phones. Now, it became kind of a thing in Istanbul. Like, if you didn't take your battery out of your cell phone, then you weren't, you know, worth it, or, you know, you weren't
Clearly, you're
important.
not in the know.
You know, you're not in the know. I think
Right,
this is a
right,
much more
right.
serious situation, because this does did represent a challenge to Erdogan. It did embarrass the prime minister. There were revelations about his family, very serious allegations of corruption, very serious allegations of the Turks double dealing with the Iranians, you know, gold to this bank called Halk Bank, which is a state-owned bank doing tremendous business with the Iranians. And then the revelation that the head of the bank had, you know, huge sums of money stuffed into these enormous boxes in his house. These are very, very serious allegations. And I think that Erdogan, they've done something very cynical. Well, they've done many things cynical, but they framed the issue as if this is some sort of foreign plot and a parallel state, so that the Justice Development's core constituency would never believe that any figure within the party was actually culpable or guilty of any of these
Right.
things. And they've just gone about purging the police forces and the prosecutors and tried to get control of the judges. And other parts of the bureaucracy, I'm sure, are next. I think that if you're suspected of being a Gulenist and you work for any, you know, Turkish government ministry, you have to be concerned about retribution on the part of the ruling party.
Yeah, I mean, and, right, and that sort of tells you, and I think it should be, you know, just to kind of parenthetically note, I think that not that, you know, things like shutting down social media and Twitter and everything, they're very important, but I think in some way, you know, that's the context for that. That's how we understand
Right,
that, more so than kind of getting lost and, you know, what particular day, what site is going down, which
right.
again is nothing particularly new. I mean, I remember when I studied in Turkey, YouTube would go down when Greek students put up an Atatürk is gay video.
Right,
You know, the site
exactly.
had to go down for a couple of days. But I guess, you know, so, you know, one thing that's striking though is that, you know, so well, I guess to back up for a moment. So we've mentioned Abdullah Gül before, who is currently, you know, he's the president. There's questions now about Erdogan wanting to become president as sort of his next move. There's also questions, you know, again, it's obviously very speculative, but you were saying like people are waiting for Gül to step up. And the public perception of Gül, and again, maybe this is just, you know, it could just be optics, but certainly temperamentally, stylistically, he seems more of the Justice and Development first term vintage,
Right.
if you know, at least in terms of the kind of how he portrays himself and how he positions himself. Now, if Gül moved against Erdogan, that would make Tony Blair and Gordon Brown look like a, you know, mediocre tennis rivalry.
That's right.
This would
That's
be like
right.
really intense. But you know, I guess and I think it's also, you know, it's interesting to note that the kind of, you know, it's like, okay, this is all taking place within this party, but you know, what are we seeing with, you know, I know again, you know, this is very speculative, obviously, but where is Gül in all of this? Does he, I mean, not necessarily step up into an overt challenge? Does he even still have the ability behind the scenes or subtly to kind of slow this march? And you know, I guess the third thing to add would be, is it wishful thinking, you know, is he completely on the same page and just more calm about it?
Well,
Yeah, I know it's a lot, so take it.
no, it's a lot,
Yeah,
and this has been something that people have been speculating about for a long time. I think there's, you know, there's a lot to go on in terms of, yeah, Gould really does represent that 2002 to 2007 AKP, AKP Justice and Development Party, consensual, moderate, decision making, statesmanlike, and so on and so forth. It's pretty clear in his public statements that are always very diplomatic. Some are oblique, some more pointed than others, that he disagrees with the way in which Erdogan has handled Turkish political arena of late. and he is an extraordinarily kind of attractive character. He is different from Erdogan. He's more worldly. He's more sophisticated. He has a kind of quiet charisma. He is popular among Turks. So people are certainly, based on all of those things, they're expecting him to step up and say to Erdogan, enough, you can't do this any longer. You're taking Turkey away from the democratic path that we, as partners in building the Justice and Development Party, and as partners once we were in government, shepherded these extraordinary changes, and you can't do this. And he hasn't done it. In fact, he's done some of the opposite things. He signed, you know, laws restricting access to the internet. He has signed laws out in making it illegal to render first aid to people during protests. He has signed a law allowing the government to reorganize the Supreme Council of Judges and Prosecutors. He's done all of these things. And that's where it gets really quite interesting. You know, why has he gone along? And it strikes me that Gül, in looking at Turkish politics and his own incentives and constraints, doesn't see a way forward. I believe that he really believes that the country has not gone in the right direction in the last number of years. And in fact, he has signed these laws, but he's also extracted promises from the government that they would change some of the most egregious parts of some of this legislation that he's affixed his name to. But that taking on Erdogan, first of all, Erdogan has proved himself over and over again to be quite an extraordinary political fighter. Erdogan's not going to, you know, Gül step forward and he'd be in the political fight of his life with Erdogan. Second, if he does step forward, he risks splitting the Justice and Development Party. That's not good for his overall view of where Turkey should be. It would be essentially handing a victory to the opponents of the Justice and Development Party, namely the Kemalists and that kind of nationalist hardcore elite that has responded overwhelmingly negatively, except for the fact that they're making a lot of money, overwhelmingly negatively to the Justice and Development Party. You know, there was, in the 1990s, you must remember this, you know, two right-of-center parties, virtually indistinguishable, the Motherland Party and the True Path Party, that were divided basically by personality differences, that it was these kinds of personality differences as well as incredible corruption on the part of leaders, that those parties are, you know, they no longer exist. Does Gül want to risk those kinds of things? So does he want to risk the Justice and Development Party, which has been a vehicle for his own success and the vehicle for the transformation of Turkey, even if he disagrees with the way it's gone as is? And does he want to risk having a fight with Erdogan, which he could very well lose? Because he has taken it very seriously, the apolitical nature of the presidency very seriously.
Right.
He still may have supporters within the party, but how does he mobilize them? As opposed to Erdogan, who, it seems, everybody owes their existence to Erdogan. So I think it would be extraordinarily risky for Gül to take him on. That then leaves us to this question of, you know, will they switch places? Will Erdogan become the president? Now, I've been saying since last spring, I thought that the easiest thing for Erdogan was for him to remain as prime minister. Once it became clear that they weren't able to write a new constitution with new executive powers for the president, that it would just be easier to change the bylaws within the Justice and Development Party that would prevent him from being elected once again as prime minister, they would just change that. But now, the result of the elections are taken as, by many in the Turkish press and elsewhere, as a sign that Erdogan could become the president, and without radically changing the powers of the presidency, because he's so prestigious, that he can continue to pull levers and push buttons and manipulate whoever would become the prime minister, and he could be an all-powerful president without it actually being formalized in a new constitution.
Right, and then I think, yeah, and then it also just kind of tracks with the, you know, even in many of, you know, at least in recent memory, Turkey's darker times, there still has been a certain institutional integrity, which you're definitely starting to see kind of consistently undermined by all of this maneuvering.
Well,
so
I think
I don't, yeah.
that's one of that's the major problem in Turkish politics now, is that nobody's taking the institutions of the state very seriously. They're either using them to advance an inherently anti-democratic agenda, or when their backs are against the wall, they're just ignoring them. That's a very bad precedent to set, and it sets Turkey back from the extraordinarily positive political reforms that they undertook in 2003 and 2004 back to the mid-1990s or before.
Absolutely. How long, before we sign off, how long are you going to be in Turkey for?
Quick trip. I'm heading out. I'll be there for 4 days before I go to the Gulf and then on to beloved Egypt.
Oh, wow. Ooh, well, Egypt, I guess Egypt will make you feel good about Turkey.
Well, they're depressing for for different reasons.
Yeah. Well, Steve Cook, this has been excellent as always. I have to go look at our article, and this is one of many future collaborations. It's always just great talking with you and working with you.
Well, thanks, Michael. It's a great pleasure, and let's do this again soon. Take care.
Okay.
See you.
Awesome. Take care, man.
Bye-bye. Bye.